When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Guys, welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. But this actually, we will reproduce this and push it out on Sports Illustrated. We are switching over to Sports Illustrated on 1 July. Wow. This could not be better timing. D-Day minus one. I'm joined by Pete Hegseth. Pete is a warrior. He is a veteran, combat veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan. And one Guantanamo tour.
Yes. That was the longest one.
I would not wish that on anyone, but you were probably exposed to things that I was never exposed to.
Sheer boredom, like you can't imagine.
And that is the hardest leadership challenge.
It was,
dealing
actually
with soldiers.
It was the most difficult leadership challenge I've ever had.
Idle time, soldiers will get in trouble. But guys, let me say this. I've read books and looked for things that I'm going to disagree with, and there were none. And Pete is a multi-time New York Times bestseller. Is it correct? I think this is his best book. Last one was the War for America.
The Battle for the American Mind.
The Battle for the American Mind. And we actually had you on for that one.
But, yep.
Let me start with this. Let me say this to the audience. I may have served 20 years, but there are very few that have studied in the military as much as you. Served, still serving, correct?
Out as of now, but very recently.
Okay. So the
otherwise, news, I'd be in big trouble, I think.
The news is off, as we say.
Yep.
But Pete served quite a bit of time. How many years total?
It would have been almost 13 total in. Yep.
13, but also did Veterans for America.
Yep.
And then Concerned Veterans for America.
A couple of vets groups, yep.
So you were involved in doing studies on the military.
100%.
Okay. Let me start with this. Why now? Why write this book right now?
Well, first of all, it means a ton coming from you to say those words. Thank you. I have an immense respect for what you've done, for what so many guys. And I actually just got off the phone with a member of, I think it was 5th Group, guy who had saw the book, read it, and wanted to reach out and just tell me more. He's like, dude, this is spot on. He said, I've been waiting for someone to stand up and say all these things that we've been seeing. And he recounted for 20 minutes on the phone, story after story, RIs at Ranger School that were changing the standards, trans commanders in a unit that women in combat areas where men couldn't have privacy and they had to treat them differently. I mean, just story after story after story, the stuff that's in the book too. Why now is because I felt like we were around the corner of a recognition of what was happening, right? I think part of my job in the media is not to see around corners, nobody can, but just to identify when the time is right to speak a truth that maybe people are ready finally to hear. And it's reached a breaking point where something can change. Because I don't want to write this book. I love the military. I love the guys I serve with. I love the units. I have respect for the legacy of what we did, even if the wars didn't end the way we wanted to. Like, that all matters to me a lot. And what's going to matter most to me is when the guys I serve with read this and let me know what they think of it. But it was time to say, I love it that much that I'm going to air some of our dirty laundry here. Because we didn't do this. This was politicians that did it, number one. And number two, generals who allowed it to happen, who didn't have the courage to stop the bullshit from rolling downhill, as it always does. And we need to call them out so that a future administration can have a full reckoning of what's happened inside our Defense Department and change it so that my kids and yours and everyone else's can confidently enter into an institution that is befitting their sacrifice, befitting potentially their life. Because I don't feel confident recommending my kids unless those things are changed. So it just felt like, all right. And frankly, I got pushed out myself. And so that was part of it too. Hey, you're going to call me that? Well, then maybe it's time that we have a candid conversation about this. And it just, I didn't want to write a book about my service. The book's not about me, but it felt like the right time. And a lot of guys came to me and said, Pete, you got to write this book.
No, this book was based off one, accountability, and two, fact. And you interweave some of your stories and your experience as well. This is not a I won the war book by Pete Hegseth. Let me ask you this. Do you think the situation with the military is getting to a point where it's irreversible?
Not yet, because I think there is a lot of common sense. There is a, first of all, you've got some of the more elite units that have been fairly insulated from it, the tip of the spear. And if I've gotten any pushback at all, which is almost none, it's been from some of the more elite units where they've been able to avoid some of it. But even a lot of those guys acknowledge, like, it's on the periphery. It's right there around the corner. We just kind of stiff arm it and do our job. And I'm glad that's the case. But it is not irreversible because the military is such a top-down institution. So if you get a commander-in-chief, like Trump said to us in our interview, where he said, I'm not doing the woke military, I'm going to fire woke generals, who's clear-eyed about it, appoints a secretary of state who's got a big set of balls and is willing to take the criticism and do what's necessary, and then you change out your chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and you have some very strategic firings of generals who've just peddled the woke crap, the gender crap, the DEI crap, the climate change electric tank crap, like all the patriot extremism stuff, and you go fired, creating the kind of ripple effect that does work inside big institutions like that. I think there are enough still, I don't know, let's say 05s, 06s, yes. You know, E7s, E8s, who've been through it, white-knuckled it through the vaccine mandates and all that, and they're like, I'm ready to do this, that you can restore that ethos. I do think it would take more than a Trump administration. I think you'd need a follow-on administration to solidify it. But you can make a hell of a lot of ground back on an institution that, for the most part, is eager to do it right. They just have leaders that have it sideways.
Pete, let me ask you this. So you were born in Minnesota, probably yep. Conservative area?
Conservative area, but not political. Like, it was just sort of like, you know, Christian families, good families.
Good American families. Yep. I was born in the Bay Area, particularly Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. Recently, actually, after our segment, the status of the military, the war on warriors,
yep.
Which, guys, go to Fox Nation. If you haven't paid for Fox Nation, the content is good. A lot of history, a lot of military. But
check it out. Thank you for doing that segment, by the way. It was great.
It was awesome. And David Bellavia, I just to sit at the table with him, and I never met him. But my mom said, hey, I don't think you'll be welcome back here anytime soon. And I come from a conservative family. She's like, these people are just living in a bubble. What I'm interested in is, the left has always held the military in just their ideology that they're a bunch of barbarians, that they're undereducated, that this is an option only for those who barely graduated high school. What's the military you know, and what is the purpose of a warrior in your eyes?
Oh, man. By the way, that's still the characterization of a lot of the left. I mean, it still is. They'll paper it over with, we support the troops, but that's still the feeling. That, I mean, listen, it is a war-fighting institution. It is... The military is supposed to be the ultimate meritocracy, whose profession is whose currency is lethality, and in the profession of arms. And you find the best people, you give them the best equipment possible, the most training they can have, and you set them loose to exact violence on the enemies of our country and to advance our interests. And preferably to deter those wars. Right? The best diplomacy is diplomacy where your State Department officials are shaking hands because there's a division of tanks behind you. And you get your way. That's why one thing I mentioned in the book, and it's a small thing, but I would love to call it the War Department again, the Department of War. Yes, we do defend our nation, absolutely. But what we do, we're supposed to fight and win wars, and we've done a lot of fighting and not a lot of winning. Mm. And that's not the fault of the guys pulling triggers. It's because we've, you know, mission creep and drift and all trying to ask the military to nation build or to export democracy. A lot of things that I went along with for a long time because I didn't know any better. And I thought, okay, well, the leaders are telling us anyway. And there's civilian leadership over the military, so I understand that. But we need to restore the military to what it was supposed to do, allow it to be very good at what it does very well. And then once it's done, take care of them and take care of the institutions. So we reorient to fight the next war we're going to have to fight, which is what we're not, what we're not doing right now. I mean, we have a military built to fight the last war, and a lot of our opponents have militaries, and especially the communist Chinese, built to defeat us. And that's a bad recipe if a shooting war does start.
As the adage goes in the military, we always say don't fight the last war, but yep. That's what you know, and that's where your experience base lies. Let me ask you this. So the Heritage Foundation has ranked the military as weak two consecutive years in a row. The Chinese also read those reports. Russia reads those reports. All our enemies read those reports. In the book, where do you sort of pinpoint the start of the decline of accountability and leadership in the military?
You can go back as far as the debates over don't ask, don't tell. But I think the real breaking point, and this Green Beret I was talking to just a few minutes ago kind of pointed it here too, and I pointed there in the book, was the debate over women in combat. Because it was so glaring. Because the military had had an understanding of maintaining standards in certain MOSs, which are military jobs, where you had to meet a threshold, or in Ranger School or Q course or whatever. This is the standard we've developed over decades and decades of knowing what it takes to be a warrior, and we're going to maintain it. And because politicians were pushing, Barack Obama specifically in his administration, studies were done that showed that all male units are far more combat effective than mixed gender units. And the Secretary of the Navy took the study and threw it out the window because the White House was pressuring. To me, that was the breaking of a dam that had already started. There were plenty of other places where that was being tweaked, but the fallout effect from that was, you know, generals walking into every unit, and you know how this works, saying something, or colonels or whatever, saying, why aren't there more females in this MOS? Which is not a question. It's a mandate. And the junior leaders say, okay, we better figure out how to do that. And you've got senior leaders reaching down into Ranger School and saying, you better pass her, and you better shift this standard at airborne school because too many women are falling out. Standards which were put in place for a reason. So once you start to say the standards don't really matter, then everything else starts to cascade. So I put a lot of it there, not only there. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this because you live this too. I mean, where would you put the finger?
So you brought up a good word, standards. There's two things that sort of are precedents in the military is accountability and standards.
Correct.
And we've seen a decline in both. Now, with the left, before we get into that, I'm going to agree with you. The don't ask, don't tell was detrimental.
Yeah.
There was a push, and you talked about it in the book, both with, Hester, who actually, she's good to go. There was a,
she's great.
I'm sorry, Megan Brown, the gal who won the Silver Star in Afghanistan.
Oh, I've
it's in the book, guys, right, but basically, if you ever remember, when she went on TV, she sort of went against the citation, and she's like, oh, well, I never carried a guy off the battlefield. That was the male counterparts that did it. And sort of there was this push to reward or recognize women. And women do amazing things, not necessarily in combat. Some of my best intel analysts were females
100%.
Who I depended on their word. Hey, I'm going to take the guys and hit this target tonight. Are you saying it's worthwhile? And I trusted her implicitly. But as we get into some touchy subjects here, it's not about the social experiment. I want to get your opinion first. The left is using the military as a social experiment. And I want you to explain to the listeners why the military culture is different from mainstream society and why it needs to be different.
Well, by the way, the military has always been sort of a social experiment. And I don't say that negatively. It was one of the first institutions to racially integrate.
Desegregation.
Desegregation happened in the military first. But it actually was... Yes, it happened. I believe it was Truman that signed it into law, but it had happened in reality in mixed units for a long time. It was racist leaders who prevented full integration, like Woodrow Wilson and FDR, who wouldn't fully accept black soldiers. But racism was more or less dead after the Korean War, especially because male and white, black and white soldiers had served together, and they understood there was no differentiation there, and the military pressed it hard and in good ways. Like my colleague Harris Faulkner has a great series on Fox Nation about her father in Vietnam. Like, talk about men who served for a nation that didn't honor them, but they did it because of the promise the country of what the country was supposed to represent. And the military had a good forcing and forging function in that way in society writ large to teach the rest of society. Do you know why that worked? It's because there's no physical difference between black men and white men. I mean, there are in the margins here or there, but like you can be a great infantryman. I could be, and so could any other black or Hispanic man, right? So the idea of discrimination breaks down. You there's no rationale for why we would have a different job inside the military. When you start forcing other differences for reasons that
biological
reasons that ignore science or ignore unit cohesion or add more variables to the unit, then the body antibody should kick in inside the military and say, we're doing something that's making me less ready, less prepared, less lethal. And when those things start to move in, oh, that's when you have real problems. So it's the don't ask, don't tell stuff back and forth. By the way, I mean, no one I know has a problem with openly gay soldiers serving and all of that. The problem is the don't ask, don't tell became a gateway. And I talked to the early guys of that movement for the transgender stuff that we see now. Transgender soldiers are totally non-deployable for the most part because of the chemical dependency that they have. So why would you want non-deployable soldiers in your unit? Like, that's never been a thing. Same with the gender stuff that we talked about. And then the critical race theory aspect is what I've found to be most dangerous because it creates inherent skepticism inside units where there wasn't skepticism before. You see, we all went through basic training or officer basic, and you get broken down, and then you all get the same uniform and the same bad haircut, and then you're all, you know, whatever individual differences you thought you have through the forcing function of that moment are stripped away, and now you're a member of a team. You're not an individual anymore. Well, now we kind of do those same things, except we don't actually enforce real standards and grooming standards, and everyone's got their own standards of what they want, and everyone's afraid to enforce it. And then at the other end, we're telling soldiers, well, you have a history of this because of your ethnicity, which should make you see the world this way. And so now we're turning them back on each other and turning them into individuals again, which is utterly toxic for unit cohesion, which is one thing in a corporation boardroom or at Harvard. It's another thing when your job is to, you know, get on a UH-60 with night vision goggles and kick down a door and you've got lives on the line right next to you. People, you're tinkering with things that make people uncomfortable in the civilian world. You're tinkering with things that get people killed in the military, whether it's elite units or even just conventional units that have, you know, mundane jobs.
So General Dunford, post-career, and I didn't know General Dunford, never met him, never directly served with him, did write a great article on why military culture needs to be distinct and separate from mainstream society. And the individuality does not work. We put a precedence on we over me. And if you can't do that, you can't aid to the mission. You're not rowing in the same direction. But let's jump into the biology. This is pure fact. The study done by the Marines, and you have it in here, which DOD at large threw out, and there was multiple studies done by multiple consulting firms, identified things like women are injured at a rate of 3 times their male counterparts. Sexual assaults per capita in that Marine unit were much higher than the per capita rate for the entire military. Now you get into tactics. They couldn't get to target as quickly. Shots were not on target. It was way less effective with a mixed unit versus the all-male units. This, in this push for females in combat, there were other studies that in a POW situation, men were willing to give up more information to protect the women. In the military I knew, was highly professional. I like in the book how you said we don't see color. We simply see standards. You either meet the standard and you're part of the team or you're out. Do you think a Trump has the ability to reverse some of these decisions? We'll get into the transgender thing because that is a mental health issue.
That's a whole nother thing.
And it's, you know, my last brief, I was at the University of Texas NROTC. I was an instructor. I was about 2 months from retiring. And I had to go through the transgender brief. And I'm looking at all the future officers, Marine Corps and Navy officers, and I'm thinking, my God, they're going to have to deal with this. And the point of it, guys, is that with the transgenders, they can come in, get all these surgeries. They're on these medications. They're not deployable. And remember, Mattis started kicking people out if they were in a non-deployable status.
Yes.
So the whole point of the military is you need to be ready to fight. You need to be combat readiness and ready to deploy. So how do we reverse these without having in the social uprising is going to be
huge.
But, you know, does Trump have the ability to do that if he gets into office? Or do you think that is just a push too far?
I think he does. I think you're going to have a Secretary of Defense that doesn't give a damn, that has the credibility and the ability to take the slings and arrows. And it can't be one of these former general types who was a part of the club and kind of will say a few tough things, but really is kind of in over here and has been a part of that. It's got to be someone who has the credibility and comes from the outside, is willing to say, hey, there's a new sheriff in town. And we're going to, you know, being sexist is illegal, always was, always has been. Being racist was illegal, always was, always has been. In the military, we knew that. I've dealt with guys who displayed certain and we knocked them down, and they knew. You know, this is, it's never been okay. It's never been okay. But it's also extremely rare. By the way, when we did the study, when the military actually did the study about racism in the military, did you read that part? The general population is exponentially more racist than the ranks of the military. They found 0.007% of service members had showcased potentially racist views after what happened after George Floyd, and everyone went crazy and lost their mind. It's not a thing. It was that's one of the most disgusting things about the book, is that they made up a boogeyman to give in to their civilian counterparts of rampant white nationalism and racism in the military that they knew didn't exist. And someone like Milley was part and parcel of that. You have to hang your shingle on accountability and standards. You have to go back to, I swore an oath to defend the Constitution. All are included and welcome, but the standards will apply to all the same. And so I don't even think you have to necessarily foreclose the opportunity for women in certain areas. I mean, personally, I would like to foreclose it just to make it a non-issue.
Let's just say for what it is, combat, meaning, MOS is,
you know, you're talking your
infantry.
Your infantry, really, you're talking like your infantry, your cav, your scouts, you're talking your elite units, like your Green Berets and your SEALs and your Army Rangers, stuff like that. But it's not, I mean, female fighter pilots and female helicopter pilots. And, you know, I don't know as much about what it takes to load artillery, but you could find out there are combat arms. Anyway, there's ways to find that distinction. I would probably carve out a few and say not happening in those units. But even if you didn't, at the very least, you say, what were the standards for men in 1996? I don't know. Let's find them. Let's look them up, because that's what they're going to be now. I mean, something like, just on the physicality side, pick a number. Let's get some smart people together and figure out when they were at their highest, when we were saying, hey, this is what the standard is, and enforce it, and allow commanders to enforce it, enforce good order and discipline. And I think a lot returns when basic standards return, and you're not allowed to factor in what their gender is or what their race is. And you have to ban the ideas of DEI and CRT. We are no longer doing this diversity is our strength thing.
That's inherent in leadership. As you just said, I saw no racism. I saw no, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen in the military. I saw professionalism at all levels, even with the men, how they treated women overseas, almost protecting them like their little sisters.
Yep.
This is the military I know.
It's again, the military I know too.
The left view is they have this preconceived notion again. And you even things, the organization that issues the most educational scholarships in the land is actually the U.S. Army. So we put a precedence on education.
True.
This is the most highly educated military in the history of mankind. So again, it's people have their narrative. And what bothers me, and I want to get into general and flag officers, because your criticism is on point. This misconception of the military and people in positions of power making decisions about the military who have never served is a recipe for disaster. Even like putting a 27-year-old Ivy League representative in the Pentagon who has authority over generals to say, no, this is what we're doing.
It's insane. It's insane. And I do think, going back to the previous question too, you just have to stand up for basic biology and be like, we're not doing this gender nonsense. Like, there are men and there are women, and men have larger lung capacity, greater bone density, more muscle strength inherently. And so they're going to succeed in a different way, and that's fine. And then you're right, political appointees, to your question now, have a huge amount of impact, and the Obama and on, extending into Biden administrations were very good about seeding their own ideologues into each of these branches.
Of course.
That's their point. Personnel is policy. And then a lot of them stuck, Mike, stuck around after Obama. I mean, and they sort of hung around and, okay, we're going to go underground. We're not going to do anything, you know, advanced that looks clearly radical, but they just keep burrowing. And they keep burrowing in places like West Point and Annapolis. Okay, we keep moving the curriculum. We got more civilian professors. What are those civilian professors bringing in? More and more of the nonsense. And it's not a criticism of Trump per se. I just don't think they really knew. And then after George Floyd, everyone was on their heels. And Milley and Austin jumped off the deep end into joining the chorus about systemic racism everywhere. And he tried to say, no, we're not renaming these bases. But they all went underground and waited for a new commander-in-chief. And in Biden, they got it. And then they've just gone after it.
The renaming of the bases was totally uncalled for. I still call it Fort Bragg. I'm not going to call it Fort Liberty. Too. Fort Hood.
We should change it back, by the way.
$40 million that could have been put towards ammunition for training for our soldiers. It goes to different issues with the budget. But
no, I'm telling you, Mike, I know I agree with you on the budget. We should change it back. We should change it back because legacy matters. Because, you know, my uncle served at Bragg. I served at Bragg. I served at Ben. It breaks a generational legacy. Legacy that matters. And where was Milley when he was the commander of Hood? I can't remember. Or Bragg. Where was he? Why wasn't he screaming about the racist base? Oh, my goodness. How in the world am I going to send troopers through basic training at a racist base? It must be changed. It's a sham. He showed up and he did it as a sham to kowtow to all the chattering class in Washington, D.C., and he should be called out for it.
So in the 60s, a man who we've both probably studied, Chesty Puller, a renowned warrior. And for the listeners, we grew up reading books about Patton and MacArthur and Chesty Puller in the long line of warrior generals and flag officers, yep. Nimitz, that came from the World War II generation onto Korea and so forth. So, you know, even Thomas Ricks wrote a book called The Generals about the decline in accountability of leadership amongst our general and admiral flag officer ranks. You don't hold back on your criticism, and I think it's well-placed. Not to say that there haven't been some great generals. Sure. Scott Miller is one that I always hold in high regard. The guy was a warrior from Mogadishu with Delta Force on through his command of JSOC and then Afghanistan. Chesty Puller said in the 1960s that generals now or generals in the future are going to be selected for how well they write a letter rather than how they fight a war. When did our general and flag ranks just lose their? It's almost like castration. And political is you talk about careerism has now overtaken it. I think we over-professionalized the military in certain ways, that we created these tracks
absolutely.
Rather than pathways.
Absolutely.
But where do you sort of paint the point at which our admirals and generals sort of just rank and file, just said whatever to yes, sir, you know?
It's a great question. There's a whole nother book that could be written by someone more familiar with the general ranks. No, about that subject. I do think you're right. There's a lot wrong there that only those inside the club would know better than those of us on the outside.
Yes, true.
You know, but first of all, we didn't win. There was never any – when you keep fighting wars and keep – over our generation of Iraq and Afghanistan, you keep – we fought those wars, you know, 1 year at a time for 20 years. And I've never met a general – that went through their tour and didn't declare definitively at the end of their tour that victory. They've succeeded,
yes.
And they've met their objectives, and they went from, you know, from red to amber to green,
yes, there
right?
You go.
I mean, that was
– I think we talked about that on the segment.
Automatic, yeah. Right? And yet the war never got better, and we always seemed to be sliding backwards. And there were moments when it got better, the surge and other things. Like, you know, we defeated guys like you, helped – crush ISIS when Trump came in. So there have been definitive tactical victories, no doubt. But how many generals were ever held to account for that? And if you don't think you're going to be held to account for battlefield successes or losses, or there's not even an objective standard over whether you've improved the situation or not, in fact, you're almost automatically promoted, then when you get a ideological president in Barack Obama or in Joe Biden who's nominating far-left people with certain theories and certain views, then why would you expect accountability now, and you don't want accountability, so you just sort of skate along? And that's what I've seen. In fact, after skate along, meaning go along. You might be grumbling under your breath a little bit, but the rationale you hear is, well, I'm better that I'm here to make it better and massage it than to retire or stand my ground and get fired. Yeah. And I've talked to two general officers since the book came out. They hadn't read it, so they didn't know what was in it per se, but they kind of sheepishly approached me and kind of confessed to being party to some of the things in the book that I talk about. But in real time, rationalizing and explaining it away, like, but that was just the future. That was the way it was going to be. We had to integrate. And so I did it the best I could to maintain the ethos. And I just sort of look at him going, you know what you did was wrong. If lethality and meritocracy and the standard and accountability is what you were supposed to strive, you know, and you rationalize it away because you wanted that third or fourth star, or if you weren't going to get it, you wanted that gig on the outside. Because careerism means if at any point along the way you buck the system or you cut against the grain, you don't get promoted or you get pushed out. And when you don't get promoted or you get pushed out or heaven forbid fired, which almost happens to nobody, then the fancy defense contracting job later on or the seat on that board is not there for you. And that's the payout for a lot of these generals. I mean, one of the modest things that I suggest, and Colonel Walls has mentioned it too, is you do a 5 or 10 year window where after you retire as a general, you're not able to serve on the board or yes. of a defense yes. contractor, so that the feedback loop sort of stops at least temporarily. But we've got to have some generals got to. I mean, there's some really courageous generals out there too who have been speaking out about this. There's an organization called STARS that is leading the way on that. So they're out there.
And not enough of our retired generals and flags are stepping up to actually take care of this problem.
They are. We need more non-retired flags stepping up, though. That's the thing.
Yes.
And that's easier said than done for someone like me. I get how much you have invested in your career at that point. But the only guy held accountable for the debacle in Afghanistan was Stu Scheller. You know? I mean, we talk about this in the special, too.
Yes.
At some point, a head has to roll so that the troops realize standards matter at the top, not just at the bottom.
So, I mean, you take it back to Benghazi. There was no accountability. Even worse with withdrawal from Afghanistan, which could not be more catastrophic to our national defense and our reputation. We are both surprised. Everyone is surprised that STARS did not end up on the table to stand their ground and say, I will not be party to this. I do find it funny that General Scott Miller retired 1 month before the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Very timely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to use a historical case example, and you do talk about it in the book, Operation Eagle Claw, there were major congressional investigations and mm-hmm. reviews that eventually, from a failure, which was become a, you could say, a watershed moment in military history, mm-hmm. from which SOCOM and JSOC were created. They found good in the bad in order to make mm-hmm. change to make, again, the trademark lethality to make us a more lethal force. Let me say this. I recently went to the Naval Academy graduation. I think it was last Friday.
Okay.
Two of our fallen teammates had sons
wow.
that graduated. One went into the Navy. One went into the Marine Corps. And you had the commandant of the Naval Academy, who you couldn't even see over the microphones. A woman, and I've got two daughters. You've got two daughters. I've got one daughter, one on the way. The most underwhelming speech. She was followed by this chief of naval operations, Lisa Franchetti.
Oh yeah,
this is a good example.
The name's in the book.
We are close to the first naval battles with a near peer military competitor
Correct.
In the Pacific. Everyone who thought was going to be the shoe-in for the CNO was the Pacific Fleet commander, was passed over for Lisa Franchetti.
That's in the book. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
And
yep.
there were the coverage on that was not all that massive.
No, it wasn't. It was actually quite positive because it was all about the first. Got to have the first.
And I'm not doubting I don't know her from Adam. I'm not saying she's not a great leader, but you're telling me against her, let's say, probably about 10 counterparts, male counterparts, that she was the best selection to lead the Navy into the next generation that may face naval battles.
First, isn't she the first female member of the
Chief of Staff?
Chief of Staff. That's yes. why. That's why. I'm sure she's a delightful person. I don't know. And maybe she's the next Nimitz. Maybe. Who knows? Probably not. And it was probably a little bit more important. how many times do you have to doubt yourself, given evidence after evidence after evidence after evidence of how important firsts are to a certain administration? And maybe we're selling her short. Maybe she is great, but it leaves the rest of us to be skeptical because of this emphasis on firsts, especially in a world where we may need that capacity more than ever. Mm. And when you've got Joe Biden or Lloyd Austin looking down and saying, okay, what's our Navy got? And if you're not, I mean, the other example I provide is Southcom. I mean, Southcom, I've got some buddies over there, and they're just like, you know, China's gobbling up influence in South America right under
They've won South America as the
right under our
said.
Nose. And what is Southcom's commander and that outfit focused on more than 50% of the time? Women leadership in South America, abortion, climate change, and gay rights in South America. As if that's what these other countries are interested in as they're being pressured, financed, cudgeled by China, and China's gobbling up our hemisphere. It's a joke. And I don't want it to be. And there's a lot of great members of Southcom, by the way, out doing training, friendly militaries and doing. I get there's stuff going on, but if your leadership is distracted by other stuff that doesn't add to a strategic objective,
It filters down. You know, I still, people say, hey, I don't have fear at the line level because they're young Americans. There's great leadership, but you can only protect them for so long before that filters down and affects lethality.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, thank you for posting the NSW Warcom pride. I was sent that very early
like that.
By somebody at Warcom.
Okay.
And I laughed because I thought it was a joke. I laughed even more hysterically when I found out it wasn't. There was no need for that whatsoever. This virtue signaling with the military has got to stop.
I had to check it.
You said it has to stop with the private sector. I don't care Absolutely. What a company is, but I found that very comedic and very sad at the same
time. I'm sorry that I tagged you in that. I'm not surprised you knew it before me, but I did what you have to do. I went and double checked. I'm like, I need to go and make sure this actually was put out by Naval Special Warfare. And sure enough, it was.
I think my response to you was, when did Warcom hire Alyssa Heiderscheid,
yes.
the VP from Bud Light? It's beyond me. And we recently saw a post where it was for PTSD month, which is a bigger issue than let's say, gay rights in the military, with the LGBT flag in the background with the president, which they've received a lot of flack. Pete, I want to end this way. One, I'm going to say to the listeners, pick this book up. Especially those in the military, you're going to agree with 100% of what is said. And you said it in a very professional, tactful, and civil way. What is your hopes from this book? And where would you go if, let's say, Trump mm-hmm. steps into office? What are the three primary things he needs to do now?
First thing he would do is, I mean, well, on a macro level, we need to repent as a nation, but that's a whole nother, that's a whole nother
good
thing.
Good luck with that one.
Good luck with that one. You need to give a signature tentpole speech spoken directly to the military and to military leadership that there is a new sheriff in town. And what's been done to the military will not stand under a Trump administration. And then I think you're going to see a lot of courage amongst junior members of the military to sort of speak up in ways they weren't emboldened to do in the past in a way that will be very healthy for the unit. So I think, and then it's hiring practices after that. And he's got a lot of smart people in there. They're going to, you know, lawyers, they're going to look in there and say, okay, here's how we can maintain our, you know, all the laws of the land without pushing a Marxist ideology onto our service members and change that. So I think there's a ton of upside and opportunity there, and we're going to need it. We're going to need it because we can't throw our pronouns at China.
Like, his appointments are going to be key.
Really
key. Even more so, I think there needs to be some relief of commanders.
Big time.
The right ones,
there have to be relief of commanders, and publicly so.
We need the Pattons and the chesty pullers of the world to step up and get us back. Pete, I've got to finish with this, and I'll give you last comments. The last portion of the book, the letter to your sons, could not have been more genuine and sincere. And that part, the way you finished that book was just well done. Well done.
Well, I appreciate it. I think it's the question on top of all of our minds. It's the way conversations end with other vets is usually with that question. What do you think? Would you recommend that your kids serve? And I've heard more no's than yeses recently, a lot more no's yes. than yeses. And I waited to write that chapter until I'd written the whole book. So I wrote the whole book, did the research, talked to people. And then I remember talking to my wife about it and a couple of other folks, talked to David about it, Bella Villa. It just kind of, I don't know. don't know. And ultimately, I just it just the weight of the whole thing said, hey, if not them, then who? If not the Hegseth boys, then who is going to join? And we need the Patriots in our ranks. And it's my job, it's your job, it's our job to get them leadership befitting of their service and their sacrifice. And so that, yeah, that, I mean, I'm hoping someday my kids read that letter. And, you know, right now they're like, oh, Dad, you write books. You know, they don't care. But someday they might.
They will.
And I reserve the right to change my judgment in 5 years when they're, or 4 years when my oldest is capable of military service. But we can't give in on, we cannot give up on the military. There's, you can move to a different state if you want lower tax rates. You can move to a different school if you don't like your school. There's only one Navy SEALs. There's only one MARSOC. There's only one 101st Airborne. Either we fix it or we lose it. And so I'm all in on being a part of solving it, and hopefully we can. We have to.
Amen to that. Well, guys, go to Best Place Amazon, anywhere
books are sold. Books are sold. If you want a signed copy, though, you can go to waronwarriors.com.
Waronwarriors.com. For a signed copy, it will be a New York Times bestseller, or screw New York Times if they they don't. Guys, again, also for the veterans listening, go to Fox Nation. I believe you get 1 year free.
1 year free for vets. Absolutely. There's a way to verify. It's really easy. And if you have a problem, we find out about it and we help get it fixed. 1 year free of Fox Nation. You can check out all the Modern Warriors, all the War on Warriors specials we've done. There's great content on there.
Lots of military content, lots of historical content.
Yes.
Even the specials, I've got to say, on ISIS, on Hamas, are very educational. And, of course, it's Fox. Everything's well done. Pete, I can't thank you enough. Congrats on the book,
thank
man. And, guys, go check it out. All right. This has been another episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I'm your host, Mike, with Pete Hegseth. We'll see you next time.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.